We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft. But Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
On the Wolfpack Sports Network from Learfield IMG College.
Play ball!
Welcome to the Nevada Wolfpack Baseball Podcast. Here's your host, Josh Sushon.
Hi again, everyone. Welcome to episode 4 of Howling with the Pack. This is a podcast about the Nevada Wolfpack baseball team as we talk to current players and former players and coaches to hear some of the stories about what makes this program special. My name is Josh Sushon. I'm your host. This is now episode 4, and we start off this episode with Abe Alvarez. He's an assistant coach for the Wolfpack. He is a recruiting coordinator for the team. He spent 7 years playing professional baseball. He reached the major leagues. He had cameos with the Boston Red Sox in 2004, 2005, and 2006. Abe, thanks so much for joining us on this week's podcast.
Great to be here, Josh. Appreciate it.
A little bit later, we're going to talk to Abe about recruiting, bringing in players to Reno, what he looks for, what he sells to recruits about playing for the Wolfpack. But we want to start off by talking about his own career. I was just looking this up, and at the time that we are recording this episode, there's been 19,929 people who have played Major League Baseball. That's it. In the history of Major League Baseball, 19,929. So you pick a stadium. Let's pick Fenway Park, since that's where Gabe played. That's about 37,000 and change. That means you could put every Major League Baseball player into Fenway Park, and you'd still have about 17,000 empty seats. But what makes Abe's story so unique is that if you take all of those 19,929, on one hand, you can count those who are legally blind in one eye, as Abe is legally blind in his left eye, which has led to stories over the years about why his cap is turned to the side, and we'll kind of get into some of that stuff. But for you, Abe, let's start off with, when did you realize, when did your parents realize that you weren't seeing normally out of your left eye, and what they kind of did to try to solve this?
It was obviously as a kid. My mom's story, I guess, I don't know how much, I don't know, I just have to believe her, I guess, right, is that I was born with my left eye had a lot of, like, the eye boogers in it. As I was a baby, I would get a lot of, like, those boogers in my eye, and so she didn't know what to do. So the doctor tried different things and then said, well, you know, there's these drops, you know, we don't know what side effects could be or what. And so the story is that my mom was like, okay, we'll just go with it and try it. And it worked. And she thought nothing of it, obviously, as I grew up. And then later, as I was probably 7, 8, or 9 around that time, third grade, she noticed that I couldn't see very well out of my left eye. And so she took me to an optometrist, and, you know, the doctor saw that my left eye needed a more magnified lens if I was going to get glasses. So that's kind of when I kind of knew something was wrong. Once I had to wear glasses, and one lens was like a magnifying glass. And then my right eye was like, I didn't even have anything. It was just like a regular, it was like I was wearing no glasses. So it was one of those things that I had to deal with as a kid. And when my mom kind of figured it out, and, yeah, there's a lot of things that I had to deal with overall as a kid, with my eye, to try to see if it could be fixed or changed, and nothing really helped. I wore glasses probably until I was in my freshman year or right before high school. But I mean, the best story was between like 9 and 12, I was a pirate every Halloween because I had to wear a patch on my good eye to try to strengthen my left eye. So I would wear a patch every day after school until like I went to bed. You know, obviously Halloween's at night, so I would wear a patch during Halloween. I was a pirate for like 4 or 5 years just because it was easy to go to. My mom just took a Sharpie and colored in my patch, and I was a pirate. So it's one of those things that I dealt with more as a kid than I did obviously once I was in high school or college or anything like that. It was something I got used to as my life went on, and I'm still dealing with now that it's just a part of my life.
How did it impact what sports you played as a kid, whether it was schoolwork or whether it was playing on the field? I mean, for the most part, I would guess that you didn't know any differently, but how did that impact your ability to see like the ball coming at you or see spin or be able to see different things?
Yeah, I think I did notice that more until probably high school, where I really had pony and colt ball, where I pitched. So there's guys leading off. So when I really had to turn my head to second, since I'm left-handed, I can see them out of the corner of my eye. Like, we teach that to our players, our pitchers now, you know, use your peripherals. Well, I couldn't use my peripherals with my left eye. It'll just be kind of like a fog or just a shadow. I didn't really know what was going on. So I knew that I had to turn my head more, especially in baseball when I was pitching. If I was playing football or basketball, I had to make sure I had to stay on the left side of the, you know, guy who was passing the ball and things like that, just so I could pick up the ball easier. So I didn't really know, but I kind of knew just because I couldn't pick things up. I wouldn't say it completely affected me, because I was just a kid and I was just out there playing, and it was just things that I felt I had to do just because I couldn't see certain things. So it was just normal for me, but it was, you know, not until I got older and things like that, I realized that there was a bigger problem than I knew.
You turn your cap to the sides, that allows you to see better out of the good eye. When did you start doing that? Whose idea was it to do that?
I think it started in high school around practice. Cause I remember my coach, high school coach, always correcting me. Coach Frank Martinez out of A.B. Miller, who's was a big mentor for me growing up in high school and throughout college. He was really strict about how the uniform looked. And I didn't even know, you know, my hat would just go on, and it's still a little bit, but it's not as bad as it got later in my career. It was just like, hey, put your hat straight. And I didn't even know. It was something I didn't even know. I just put my hat on and I would go like this, and it would kind of clear my view a little bit of what I was looking at, but I didn't even pay attention to the way my hat was going on until probably later as I got into college and into my pro career, where I was really like, oh, okay. Like, I could see a little bit clearer, and it probably went a little bit too much than it should have gone. Cause now it kind of, my hat's a little bit more higher where I could just see a little bit normal, but it wasn't no one's idea. It was just the way my hat went on, and I just kind of tucked it to the left, and it kind of stuck that way.
you went to Long Beach State and you were on some really good teams. I affectionately refer to all of the Long Beach State guys around college baseball, especially on the West Coast, as the Long Beach State Mafia, because the tentacles just go everywhere. But geez, you and Jared Weaver were the Friday and Saturday starters there for a while. You know, he's from the right, you're from the left. What are some of your memories or best memories of just you and Jared just competing, you know, back-to-back nights and really getting after it?
I think that's what it was. And it was about competing. You know, I came in my freshman year, year before Jared. Jared is actually older than me, but he was a year behind in school. He came in my sophomore year. So my freshman year, I came in and I thought I was all right. You know, I'm going to compete my freshman year. And I didn't do anything of that at all. I only got like four innings my freshman year. It was adjustment mentally for me. Coming from high school, understanding what college baseball was. So then my sophomore year, I worked hard over the summer and I won the Friday night job, and Jared came in and I knew he was full of talent just watching him in the fall and getting to know him. And he didn't pitch it on Sunday, his freshman year. And it was just one of those things, we competed against each other just because we became really good friends. And I knew he was always going to bring his A stuff because he was very talented. And I knew I had to just work a little bit harder to keep my spot more than anything at Friday night, because he was willing and ready to take it anytime he could, especially my junior year. You know, me being Friday night, still my junior year, and then him going Saturday, it was like, I had to set the table enough where I knew he was going to be fine that coming in that next year. So it was really big for just a competition where he was going to push it, and then I was going to come right back with it, or I was going to push it and he was going to come right back with it. It was just head and head. The best was the falls on inter squads when we went against each other. It was one of those things like, all right, I'm going to go five, you're going to go five. Who's going to strike out guys? You know, who's going to kind of come out of it on top? That was the fun part. Obviously, the spring when the games matter is always fun, but when you go head to head against one of your good friends, it's always fun in the fall.
When did you get a sense that I can play professional baseball, that my stuff's going to translate, that I know that this is not just a goal, but I know this is a realistic goal for me?
I'd say probably after my sophomore season. After my sophomore season, I obviously had a really good year. I competed and I beat some really good teams. Obviously, you know, pitched against USC opening night. They're like third or fourth in the nation. And I, you know, I beat them, pitched against a couple of Pac-12 teams, Arizona State. And I kind of beat them. So and kind of after that season, I made Team USA. I tried out for Team USA and I made Team USA, and just seeing the people around me was like, oh, okay. You know, Dustin Pedroia is a freshman, you know, on the Team USA. There's Ryan Garko, there's Carlos Quinton, there's all these Stanford guys, there's just all these tons of Ricky Weeks, you know, all these players who are now played in the major league. That was kind of what was, you know, okay, if I belong here, then I think I could probably get it to the next level if I have a good junior year to be able to get drafted out of Long Beach.
Okay, so now it gets to your junior year and scouts are paying a lot more attention to you and they start talking to you and they start thinking about where it is that you're going to get drafted. And how does not being able to see completely out of your left eye impact what scouts, what teams are thinking about your potential as a professional athlete?
Well, that was the weird thing for me. Obviously, in those days, scouts, you know, call you and, hey, want to set up a meeting. So they'd be coming over, the house I lived with a couple of teammates and some friends, and they're trying to set up meetings and it kept going on and on with different teams. And I forget what team it was. And they asked, hey, you know, we're going to do these tests. And I was like, yeah, great. You know, I'd done different ones. And then they gave me an eye test where I had to, like, you had to press a button in the dots. You had to pick the dots where the dots were. And by the end, at the end of the test, he's like, do you know you can't see really good? You weren't picking up stuff really good with your left eye. I was like, oh, yeah. Like, yeah, I knew that. Like, it wasn't a big deal to me. I was like, yeah, okay. So then that happens, and then probably at least 4 days later, MLB comes and does a test on me for the draft. And he goes, at the end of the test, he goes, whoa. He's like, you're like legally blind out of your left eye. And I was like, really? I was like, I don't think so, but sure. Okay. Yeah. If you say so, because he said I didn't pick up anything with my left eye. And so I was like, oh, okay. So then I'm not really worried against Steele. I don't know why. I mean, more of probably the way I grew up. My dad's pretty calm and my mom pretty collected. And my, you know, I've just grown up to be like, don't just be you and whatever happens, happens. But then my agent calls me, or my advisor at the time calls me about one day, like a day later. He's like, hey, what's going on with your eye? I was like, what do you mean? What's going on with my eye? He's like, MLB's telling me you can't see out your left eye. And scouts are calling me. I was like, well, yeah. He's like, why don't you tell me? I was like, well, there's nothing to tell. I mean, what do you want me to say? And Paul Cohen and Tim Trafficana, who represented me, they're like, oh, okay, okay. They're like, okay, we'll see what's going on. And I was like, and I told him, I was like, it's nothing to worry about. I was like, if I had all this success already, I mean, that means it hasn't affected what I could do. And they're like, yeah, you're right. You know, we'll spin it or whatever they had to do. And I was like, it doesn't matter. So that was kind of the big thing. They thought it would affect me in the draft. And I guess it did. I mean, I guess some teams were interested in taking me in the first round. Like the Diamondbacks called during the draft towards the end of the round and then decided not to take me. And they went with Carlos Quinton. But the Red Sox took me then not that long, much longer. So I don't know how much it really affected in the draft, but there was a good 2 weeks between scouts and MLB and my agent where it was like a panic, like something was wrong. And it affected me like right when I got into pro ball, where the medical staff at Boston said, hey, you got to wear protective lenses. Doesn't matter if they're for you to see or not. Every time you're on the field, you have to have protective lenses to protect your eye, because if you get a foul ball to your right eye, your career is done, possibly. And that's why I still wear them now. You'll see me with clear glasses at night or with, you know, sunglasses during the day, because if a ball does come my way, you know, my coaching career or, you know, my just the way I live now could be affected by baseball.
Did you feel like every step of the way, you mentioned about your high school coach was firm about this is how you wear a uniform. And so then you go to Long Beach State and then you go into professional ball, that every place, did you kind of have to explain, or did people start, you know, why has this guy got his cap to the side? You know, baseball people can be very rigid and very strict about things. Was it just like a constant thing of people going, what is with this guy in his hat?
Yeah, it was constant. I got it a little bit more as I went to college. You know, we played, I remember freshman year, I traveled early in some non-conferences and went to Arkansas. And Arkansas looked at me like, you know, who do you think you are? You know, you don't wear your hat, you know, shouting from the stands. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, I didn't know what I was doing wrong. And there was always someone, you know, was asking like, hey, you know, what's going on with your hat? Pro ball the same. Hey, what's going on? Why do you have to wear your hat like that? Why do you wear a hat like that? And again, I didn't know how bad it got until I started seeing pictures, but I would just put it on and turn it. I think some hats would differ. I used to have long hair, so sometimes the way it sit on my hat, my hair would be different. And when I got shorter hair, it would really, you know, it was just one of those things where I was in like, oh, I'm going to be the cool guy and turn my hat to the side. I was never about that. You know, I did grow up listening to hip hop and people thought it was that, oh, he's a hip hop guy. And he's going to, you know, look a little ghetto or whatever, however they want to call it. And it was never about that. It's just, I put my hat on and I just kind of tucked it and it just helped me kind of be me and see a little bit more. And that was it. So yeah, the question is constantly always asked and people are still now will ask me like, you know, you're blind. I was like, well, according to this and this, yes, but I actually got my Nevada license earlier this year during the quarantine, right after it kind of died out a little bit. And I went and took a vision test and they had these goggles things that you put in And I read the, and I read, and I, it was kind of funny to me. I read the actual letters and I was like, boom, I got them all. And she's like, no, 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 you're missing the first four. And I was like, what? And so I closed my good eye and I was like, oh yeah. And it's all, I can't, and I can't see anything. It's just a big, huge blur. And I was like, yeah, I can't see that. Sorry. So she put like, I don't know, 20 over 40. But then like for my left eye, she put like 0/20. I'm like, oh, okay. So I guess I am legally blind because now Nevada, the state of Nevada thinks I can't see it on my left eye. But I got my license, so I'm good.
Let's talk about your professional debut. So after you get selected by the Red Sox in the second round, they send you to the New York Penn League. You're with the Lowell Spinners. And you made 9 starts that year. It looks like they wanted to limit the number of innings because you threw so many in college. But nonetheless, I mean, there's like a good debuts. And then there's a debut in which your ERA is 0.00. It was 19 innings, 2 runs, and those were both unearned runs, 2 walks, 19 strikeouts. Okay, you can brag a little bit. Did you think that like, okay, the Big West was way harder than the New York Penn League or what?
No, I think what it was is what they limit. They're wanting to keep me kind of in a routine of starting, but I would start and go 1 or start and go 2. So it wasn't that I was just kind of completely going through it. I was getting starts, but I wasn't going through the lineup. You know, not until probably my last start. I think I went 4 innings or something like that, where I went through the lineup twice. So it wasn't nothing like that. I mean, the difference is now these guys have wooden bats. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a huge difference coming from, you know, college. Now I could throw my fastball a little bit more middle and miss a little bit better, and they're still kind of maybe miss hit it than an aluminum bat. So, I mean, that was the biggest, like, more of a confidence. Like I could still be me and pitch the way I pitch and probably get better results because these guys have wooden bats. So it wasn't that, it was different. I just think I was limited in the innings. So that was kind of the success in those numbers were obviously changed the next year going to Double A.
Yeah, but still, I mean, you go from short season ball to Double A, you skip Low A, you skipped High A, you go straight to the Portland Sea Dogs Eastern League. You know, what did the Red Sox tell you? What did you think about this rapid advancement from short season ball to Double A?
I didn't really had no idea. We didn't really talk about it until, you know, in spring training, they just have the different fields. And as you go through spring training, you're practicing with this team or with this group of guys. And then all of a sudden, as spring training gets closer to an end, they start putting you on different fields. Oh, this field's going to be Low A, this field's High A, this field's Double A, and so on. And then at some point during spring training, you don't even know. You go up to the list and you look at what field you're on. And I saw my name in Double A and I was like, oh, okay. Like maybe I'm just going there for a little bit, like during spring training to get some innings in or what. They kind of want to see what I could do during spring training against Double A hitting. It's probably what happened. I just didn't pay attention to that stuff really early in my career, just because I was trying to make a team. In a sense, I know I was a second rounder and there's money involved, but the goal was to make a team. So I don't know how much it benefited me. I could say now, looking back and kind of looking at my career, I would say kind of hurt me more than anything as far as development. I didn't feel like I got a full developed into a professional pitcher, but maybe they thought I was ready right out of college, and that could have been the thing where I was more of a command guy and I wasn't going to blow it by guys. So they felt my command was good enough to move a lot quicker, but I could see probably hurting my development as far as learning how to pitch at the pro level, you know, at those lower levels to then make my way up a little bit easier. But obviously some good things came out of it, obviously being able to play in the big leagues, but I could say I could probably could have used some more years to develop and learn a little bit more about pitching and pro ball than actually just getting thrown in the fire right away.
Yeah. I mean, for most guys, I mean, just to make it to the major leagues is an accomplishment. To do it, you know, I would say the average is probably anywhere from 3 to 5 years of guys going through the minor leagues, but you get drafted in 2003 and about, let's see, 14, 15 months later, you're in the major leagues. Tell us how you learned that you were going from Double A to the major leagues to make your debut.
I was obviously in Double A and we're, I want to say in Connecticut. I want to say we're somewhere in the Northeast, obviously. And I had guys on that double A team who were local guys, like, you know, they're from New England area, and they would listen to the radio. And I try to stay away from that, but they're grew up Red Sox fans. And they told me like after, you know, I had 2 days after my last start, and they're like, hey, there's rumors that you're coming up, or that my buddy Chris Smith, who I actually have pitched against in the Big West, who was with us too, that it might be one of you two for a doubleheader. And I was like, oh, that's great. That's awesome. And then a day later, my head coach, Ron Johnson, who recently passed away, he called me in and said, hey, you're getting called to the show. And I was like, no way. I was like, I'm 21 years old and I just got drafted. I was like, no way. And I looked to the pitching coach and he's like, yeah, you're going up. And I was like, well, all right. And he said, congratulations. And then they're trying to be really hush hush about it. They're like, hey, Boston, you know, they're going to get me up there a couple days early. I think the start was on maybe a Thursday or something. They wanted to get me there like on a Tuesday, just to make sure I got there. And they're like, you can't tell anybody. I was like, I can't tell anybody. Really? I can't tell anybody I'm going to the big leagues. They're like, pack your bag, but say like, you have to go. I was like, no one's going to believe me, but okay, I'll go with it. I was like, I gotta go see my mom. I don't know what I said. And obviously I get back to my room and my roommate, who was John Haddig, he was like, what do you got? And I was like, I'm going to big leagues. I was like, and he was like fired up. And, you know, I called my parents to make sure they got on a flight out to Boston. And I made sure that was done. Called my high school coach, called Buck, who was my coach at Long Beach, and called Coach Weathers, and called all my friends. And, you know, I drove up the date. I was in Connecticut. So, you know, took a car up to Fenway, and Tito Francona was the first guy to greet me as I got out of the car, and he took my bag and he said, let's go. And I was like, all right, let's go. And, you know, got there and did some throwing on the field with Coach Mills. And, you know, then they put me in a hotel and they said, hey, you just stay in that hotel until we tell you you're good to go. Because of obviously the roster changes, a guy couldn't be up there, you know, because of the roster changes. And then they said, all right, you're on the roster. You're starting the first game. You know, I think it was like a 1 o'clock game or noon game in July. So it was hot and humid and it was awful, just the humidity. But it was the big leagues. And I walked out there and, you know, tried to make it the same game that it's always been. And I had some successes, but obviously the strike zone in the major leagues is a lot smaller than I was used to. But I was able to obviously achieve every kid's dream and do it in front of my parents and, you know, in front of, you know, people who are watching at home at 11 o'clock in the morning, you know, all at, or 10 a.m. I forget, you know, I remember friends calling me. And you always hold that moment in your life. And then you go, all right. And then, you know, got sent down before the second game started. And I was in the suite with my parents just hanging out. And I was like, you guys want to go or want to watch? And they just wanted to hang out with me. So it was just cool to experience. But I was in double A the next day. You know, it was one of those things.
Was there a moment, whether you're walking from the bullpen out to the mound at the start of the game or before an inning or when you got – taken out or anything, where you just kind of like looked around and just looked at all the fans at Fenway and just tried to soak up that moment?
Yeah, definitely walking out to go warm up, just because the greatest thing about Boston Red Sox fans and that fan base out there is they know everything. They knew who I was, and they knew where I was trapped. They knew what I did in short A. They knew everything. And they're really positive about, you know, just me being there. They all, you know, I could hear them wishing me luck, go get them, Alvarez, this and that. So that was cool. So you do look out. Now the stadium wasn't fully, you know, it wasn't packed yet at that time when I was going out there to throw. But yeah, it was just, that was a cool moment. But just understanding the fan base and who they were, that was really the cool part, because, you know, I think I went five innings and five walks and gave up five. It was a bad line. I've never walked five people in my life, and I was like, whoa, okay. They're still, you know, they still are like clapping and, you know, they're like, all right, you know, he'll be back, or, you know, they understood the process. It was, they knew I wasn't going to be there. They knew it was just a start, and that was kind of cool. You know, obviously a win would have been better, but, the atmosphere of Fenway, you know, you never let go of that. I mean, even when I hear, you know, Sweet Caroline at any stadium now, I was like, you can't play that. Unless you're at Fenway and experience that at Fenway, it's hard to listen to, because just eighth inning at Fenway and that song goes on and you hear the whole crowd go bup, 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 and you're like, whoa, you know, it just kind of blows your mind. So, you know, every time I hear that song, I always go back to those moments of my time at Fenway, and it kind of hits again.
I read a story where, as you were pitching that day, Curt Schilling and Johnny Damon, that the camera panned to the dugout and they had moved their caps a little bit to the side as a show of like support or solidarity. I'm wondering if you were aware of that at the time, or when you became aware that, you know, two all-stars, big time guys, you know, in the major leagues had done that for you.
Yeah, I didn't know until after the game, like after I got back to the hotel and, you know, watched the highlights and stuff, and the story was there. Not that, but it was pretty cool. Obviously Kurt, you know, his career and what he did for that city, especially in 04 that year, and what happened, it was kind of cool. You know, I never talked about it with Kurt later or anything like that. He wasn't one of those guys, but he was one of those guys, again, that didn't know my story. Mm-hmm. And once I think the talk was in the dugout was the same thing. Like, why does he have his hat like that? And I think as they found out throughout that game or during pregame, they're like, oh, okay. And kind of, they showed that support. And Johnny's a good guy where, I remember talking to Johnny, and I didn't talk to him about that, but he would come out and play cards with us in spring training and stuff like that with the young guys. So it's good to know that, I had teammates who weren't yet really my teammates, but just in one game, they supported me and whatever they heard and what they knew about me, so I could succeed in some way that game.
When the 2004 playoffs are taking place, and you know these are they were your teammates for a day, but this is your employer. It's the Red Sox, and of course you want them to win. And, you know, and they had this historic run and they win the World Series. What would be your routine if there was any kind of routine in terms of watching the Red Sox run from your home?
It'll just be me. I would be in front of, I don't know, wherever I was. You know, obviously I was home in Long Beach. So wherever I was, whether it's with friends or by myself at home, however I was watching it. Just because, you know, the year before in 03, I was in instructional league down in Florida, and I had to leave. I actually flew home on my birthday for one of my cousin's weddings in Arizona. And I remember talking to my buddies, Jesse Korn and Papel Bond was with me in instructional ball, and they're winning. I remember Red Sox were winning. And then I got home from my flight from Florida to LA, and Boone hit the knuckleball out of the park, and I was like, whoa, you know. So it was one of those things that, you know, you get picked up by a team and they're in your employer, but that's, you know, you want them to win. So in 04, having me been up to the league, now being home with friends and teammates and former teammates who were at Long Beach, was like, oh, gotta watch the Red Sox, you know, gotta watch the Red Sox. So there was no routine. It was just gotta watch the Red Sox. And as you saw it develop, especially after the 3-0 and what happened with that and winning, you know, obviously 8 straight, it was really, really cool to see. And knowing that I spent one day with that uniform on and with that team was really cool, to just know that they did that.
As long as you spend one day with the team, that means that you get a ring. So you got a World Series ring. How was it presented to you?
I had no clue. Obviously, it was my first big league spring training that following year, since I was on the 40-man roster. And Mike Timlin came up to me, and Alan Embry, two relievers, came up to me, and they're like, hey, dude, your name's up there. You got to go get Sizer a ring. And I was like, stop. I was like, okay, I get it. I'm the rookie. You know, I'm the young guy. You guys are pulling my leg. I'm going to go up there and be like, who are you? You know, I'm going to get one of those. But then Lenny DiNardo, who was I was with in AAA for a couple of years, and he got some big league time, was like, no, Ape, your name's up there. I was like, whoa. So it was kind of cool. I got up there and, you know, spring training, and I said, and they asked for my name. And I said, Abe Alvarez. Like, oh, okay, yeah. And got size for a ring, and I came back, and I was just, I just went up to Tim Lynn and Embria, and I said, thanks, guys. I was like, I think it was more of a team decision after I heard a little bit more that they would give one to everybody who spent any time. I mean, there's guys who didn't even throw a pitch or play having at bat who got a ring. And I just said, thank you. I was like, that's kind of cool, you know, for you guys to do that as a team. So it was very humbling, and also cool that I was included, that I would be included for just one, for five innings, you know, of 2004. And a loss that I would be included in that. So it was kind of cool. I would say, oh, you know, they got hot right after I left, you know, something like that.
How often do you, you know, what types of occasions do you bring out? Because the World Series rings, they're so huge and so gaudy, you can't just wear it on a day-to-day basis. What are some occasions in which you'll break it out and wear it?
Weddings, you know, weddings, our leadoff, when we have our Dolan dinner, I'll usually have it, you know, special occasions like that. I used to do it a lot. Obviously, right away, you kind of want to wear it, and, mm-hmm. you know, it's always nice to have, but now it's far and few between. You know, when I do wear it, it'll have to be a special occasion. But it's cool to have, you know, Coach Hunt, Kyle just got married this past November. I wore it at his wedding, things like that. So it's cool. It's cool to see. I still have it in the box, and I have my, you know, I have this little area my wife put together. It's in our house where to have my World Series jersey, kind of the one they gave us at opening day when they gave us the ring. And then I have the box with the ring there. I have my USA jersey with my silver medal. And then I have my Long Beach jersey, you know, so it's kind of that trifecta of things. So it's always cool being in that little spot, and I can always kind of look at it and stuff like that. But it's far and few between where I really take it out. I'll take it out with recruits on a visit from time to time. That's for sure. To make sure they understand, you know, what it is and, you know, what it takes, you know, even if I just had a couple cups of coffee, I still got a ring, and they, you know, it's good for them to see, because I know it's their goal at some point as well.
What about college graduation and what that meant to you to go back? You know, did you wear the ring at college graduation? And just,
I want to say I did. Yeah. I want to say I did. I obviously, my bachelor's, the big thing about college graduation was, you know, I always told my mom I would do it. I'm the only one in my family to get a college degree. Even in my extended family, as one of the only males, which is kind of cool. And my mom's one of 13 and my dad's one of seven. So there's a lot of cousins and stuff like that. So it was always cool to go back to Long Beach and be the undergrad for Coach Weathers as he retired, and to be there for Buck's first year, and then graduate and get my degree from Long Beach, and then get my master's later in education a couple of years later. I definitely wore it for that, just because it was a combination of all things that I was brought up to do. You know, it was the hard work, the being humble, the understanding of where you come from. It was all combined in one of those. So yeah, my college degrees are big. I think almost not as big as obviously getting a World Series ring, because you have that kid dream, but to be able to do that and have two degrees is a big deal.
So you had a couple of other cameos in 2005 and 2006 in the major leagues, but for the most part, you spent a lot of time at AAA Pawtucket. What are some of your just biggest takeaways about, maybe it's life lessons? You know, look, when you're at AAA, it can be such a tease, right? Because you're constantly one twisted ankle, you know, or, you know, from going back to the major leagues, and it can be such a mental grind. You know, I've heard the phrase so often when I'm at AAA is just, you know, be where your feet are. And that's easy to say, and it's hard to do. And so when you reflect on those years of trying to get back and what it took and all of those bus rides and all of those commercial flights about life in the minor leagues and grinding away, like what are the biggest things that come to your mind?
Yeah, I think you put it right. Be where your feet are. And that was the biggest thing. I think the biggest, the coolest thing is try to be a teammate as much as you can there with other guys. Because you know, it's like, it becomes a competition, kind of goes back to college. You know, I had a couple of teammates and David Pauly, who got some big league time, and Charlie Zink, who got a one start. And I knew if Pauly was going to go out and go six innings and give up, you know, two runs and five hits, I had to do the same thing, because if I didn't, then they're going to consider him for a spot start instead of myself. So that competition kind of always stayed there, and that was important. But afterwards, you got to kind of just grind it out. You know, you got to kind of stay with it, because you can't be looking up at the bigger brother all the time. You're looking at them for win and things that happen good, but you can't stick your nose in the paper and look at the transaction report all the time, you know. And some guys got stuck doing that. And for me, it was more of a learning experience. You know, I was 22 in AAA, or 23. So I was trying to learn as much as I could. And I had some, you know, good guys around me. Sean Wooten, who's a World Series champion with the Angels, was like one of the best catchers that I just got to talk to about pitching. And he said, hey, you could throw a left on left change, but if you extend and you throw it on this side, you know, I just learned a little bit more, you know, about certain things that he knew. David Berg, who played in the big leagues with the Blue Jays for a long time. Just talking with older guys, since I was so young in AAA, having the opportunity to talk with guys who were probably my age, where I'm now, I'm 38. These guys were still playing. And I was learning so much. And I was trying to take advantage of that as much as I could. But it was also hard of going through the grind every year of AAA and not knowing when I was going to come up, or if I was going to get a chance, or if this was my plateau and this is where all I was going to get. So yeah, the mind plays with you and you try to be normal as you can, but it's definitely challenging being in AAA at a young age, not knowing if this is as high as you're going to go, or if you're going to get a chance to prove yourself again at the next level.
When did you know that it's time to retire and move on to the next phase of your life? Like, what are the signs? What are the reasons? And what do you need to do to be at peace with that decision?
It's hard, I guess. Going into 2008, I want to say 2008 is when I was released, and I was the only guy in AAA not on the 40-man roster. So I kind of knew I knew if I didn't produce, either it was my last year, or they would release me at some point during that season. So it did happen. It actually happened on Mother's Day in 2008. And after that, you know, obviously it's kind of an emotional feeling, and you don't know what's going to happen next. And I talked to my agent. I was like, what do I do? He's like, stick around for about a week and see if someone picks you up in the same league, obviously there, and you could just drive over or meet that team wherever. Nothing happened in that week. So I was like, I'm gonna go home. I drove my car across country, took me 3 days. And I was like, what do you got? And he's like, well, you could go the independent route and finish your season and see what happens. I said, yeah, let's do that. And played with the Camden River Sharks they picked me up and I played with them for about 2 weeks or so, and then they traded me to Long Island Ducks. I played in Long Island for the rest of that season. And then kind of once I got a understanding of what independent ball was, I had a feeling that I wasn't going to be around for that much longer. Just not because of the grind, just because I knew there are other things that were going to be in place for me to do in my life, in my career. Baseball wasn't the all end as a player. It wasn't what I was destined to do for the rest of my life after that happened. I decided to have some fun. Obviously, went to Italy my last professional year. I had one of my best friends played out there for a long time. He was actually the best man at my wedding, Paul Macaluso. And he's like, just come out. He's like, come out, try to see what it's about. Yeah, and I got my passport, and it was like college baseball. It was Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You know, you practice throughout the week. The Italian guys like go to work during the day and come out and play. It was fun. They were getting paid. It was fun for them, but it was great. You know, pitched on Friday night, just like college, did my thing. I was on the worst team in the league, but it was a good time. And then I was done. You know, another team wanted me to come back for the year after. I did a tryout for a California independent league just because I was trying to hang on by that last little thread. And my wife tells me about it all the time. She's like, you wanted it, but you didn't want it. And you just had to go out and know and fail so you could be done with it. And I was like, you're probably right. And then, I kind of knew it was, there was something else that I needed to do with my life. And I'm glad I was able to kind of push the playing career to start my new life.
When did you know that you wanted to coach? What was the, what was the reason? What was the decision-making? Why did you want to coach?
I always knew. I think it was something that I always knew in high school. I had a great history teacher, Mrs. Marica, AB Miller High School, and obviously Coach Frank Martinez, who was my high school coach. I didn't want to be him, but I wanted to be what he was doing, at the high school level. I wanted to teach history, and I wanted to coach baseball. It's kind of like that, kind of that thing. Your high school coach is either a PE teacher or a history teacher, right? So it's like, I wanted to do that. It's just something that obviously I saw in my life, as I saw a really great teacher in the classroom, and I saw a really great coach on the field, and someone who took care of his players and what they did. And I envisioned that for my life. I always did. I knew plan B was I'll get my degree, I'll teach, and I'll coach. And I ended up doing that for 6 years. And it was a lot of life lessons that were for me, but I was also able to give a lot of life lessons for the high school players and students that I taught over on the classroom and on the field that I'll always hold close to my heart.
So then why college? Again, this is the Long Beach State Mafia, right? You played for the Dirtbags. TJ Bruce did. You guys did not overlap as teammates, but everyone with Long Beach State knows each other. Tell us what brought you to Reno to coach for the Wolfpack.
Well, it was one of those things that I knew I wanted to do it. I just didn't know when the right opportunity was going to be. I had to convince my wife probably 5 or 6 times to kind of, hey, this is kind of what I want to do. But she liked me teaching and coaching. We had a good lifestyle of what we're doing, but it was always something. It's always right. You teach. I mean, I was coaching at a small Catholic school in West LA, St. Bernard. The school population was like 290 co-ed. I had to wait for football and basketball to be done before I got my team together on the baseball field. I had like 5 real baseball players, and then all the other guys just kind of showed up. So it was one of those things where I knew the highest level of baseball, and I was trying to teach the highest level of baseball to these kids, but I knew they're only going to get 1 or 2 things out of it. And I'm glad. I'm very happy they got those 1 or 2 things, because some of those students and players still text me and call me and email me and tell me and thank me for those things, which is one of the things you want as a teacher. And I just knew, like, I wanted to go up a step higher. And obviously me and TJ are really good friends. He's one of my closest friends. And when he got the job at Nevada, I was like, that's awesome. We talked through his recruiting stuff at we coached together at Long Beach for 1 year. And when he went to UCLA, I would follow him. And then he got the job at Nevada, and he's like, why don't you come up and come be my volunteer? And I was like, I don't know. I think me and my wife were pregnant with our second with Benjamin. So I was like, I don't know if it's the right time. It's probably not the best time. And then as my career kind of kept going in high school, I ended up being the dean of students at the school, and I got into administration, and kind of then I saw kind of the black and white, like, this is not who I really am. I need to be on the baseball field as much as I can. Me and my wife talked about it, and TJ came back to me. He's like, hey, I don't have a volunteer. We use someone else, but I really need a volunteer. And, I know you and what you know about baseball. And obviously we were taught the same type of baseball at Long Beach State and being a dirtbag and what that's about. He's like, you need to think about it. And we came up here for an Easter watched the game. I hung around the cage and, you know, this and that. And we weren't really thinking about it, me and my wife. And then TJ and his wife, Heather, you know, were at their house for Easter. And they're like, so what do you think? When you guys kind of come up? And me and my wife look at each other. We're like, whoa, this is for real. And, you know, we're people of faith. So we prayed about it and kind of looked to what was the best for our family and what was the best for my career and her career. My wife's still a teacher. She teaches here, obviously, at Little Flower. And she's like, let's, you know, if there's something you really want, let's do it. She's like, we'll take the leap and see where it leads us. And it was one of those things where I wasn't going to do anything unless I had the support of my wife, obviously, and it was the best thing for my family. And I think it, you know, now that we look back on it, this will be our third, you know, going into our third year here. It's probably the best decision as far as our family, the four of us, and how we've grown and how I see my kids grow and being here in Reno. So it's worked out. And obviously, I thought I'd be a volunteer for 2 years and then try to get a paid job, or maybe teachers say, hey, someone's interested in you. You got to go, you know, go somewhere else. But it's worked out. It's worked out here with TJ, and obviously now Buck's here, and obviously I know Buck. Buck taught me, you know, everything about pitching as much as I know from Long Beach. It's come really full circle as far as coaching and being a part of a staff that we know a lot about each other. And, you know, I get to, you know, teach kids who want to do what I did. And I think that's the biggest thing, is I could talk to players a little bit differently because they're trying to get to where I got to at some point. And I could tell them, well, you can't do that. But, you know, I could tell them certain things. It's like, you know, you got to get better at this and better at that if you want to just get the opportunity. Because now the way things have changed with MLB in the draft, you know, a lot of kids are not going to get opportunities. So things, you know, certain players who are going to get that opportunity to get better in certain points.
There's so many things about college baseball that's just crazy to me. I don't even know where to begin other than the idea that like one of the coaches has to be a volunteer, or like it doesn't get paid. Like that doesn't happen with other sports on campus. And I know that TJ has been candid over the years about talking about like the work that he did on the side in order to support his family. So if you don't mind, when you're a volunteer coach before you got paid, like what did you do to make sure that there's food for your kids, there's a roof over your head for your family?
Well, luckily my wife obviously is a teacher, and she, you know, she's at a private school, so there's a lot of good things there. Applying for different jobs, and you know, obviously TJ having connections, I was able to help out at different places throughout the community. And what they were able to provide me was some sort of work. The more labor, you know, Kyle does it now, right? So I applied at Western Nevada, and Kyle works at Western Nevada, and it's kind of the same stuff that he used to do. But I remember more being at Long Beach and being an undergraduate and being with TJ, and we used to work together on the pier, out at the ports in LA. And that's what I remember more, because essentially I was kind of volunteer with him there. That's how I was making money. We used to work at, you know, Los Angeles ports down, you know, in San Pedro, and I have to wake up, you know, get there by 6 a.m. and do our drives and help with the fire extinguishers, the oxygen and tanks for the divers who go underneath the thing. It was kind of a lot going on, and then really getting then figuring out, oh, practice is at this time, and talking to your supervisor and saying, hey, we got to go. You know, I know we're in a job, but we actually got to go do this, you know, which is what we really want to do. And I think that was a tough part. But the big thing about college baseball and communities is that there's people in the communities who are going to support that program and help out those coaches and former players who need a job, a part-time job, just to kind of stay afloat, you know. And that's what's good. What was always great about Long Beach and the support that supported, you know, Coach Snow and Coach Weathers and Buck while they were there. And then the support we have here in Reno, which is, you know, ultimately one of a kind with, you know, the Dolan family, Rick Rubilio and things like that, where they're going to support our team and give us those odd end jobs to kind of stay afloat in order to support our family as much as we can.
The other thing about college baseball that's so different than anything else on campus, and this gets into the recruiting end, is that you can sign the best recruiting class in the country, and then they all get drafted and none of them end up on campus. So for you and for Buck and for TJ, what's kind of like your philosophy in terms of, we want to recruit someone who's good, who's really good, but we don't want to recruit someone who's so good that they'll never end up on campus. How do you balance that?
I think you can and you can't at some point, because you want the best player, obviously. And if he doesn't make it to campus, I think it's fine. I think it's like, well, we didn't expect that, but at the same time, we did expect that because we saw the talent level at, you know, when he was a sophomore or a junior. Like, okay, you know, he progressed quicker than we thought. Now, there obviously, you do get some of those guys, and, you know, you're happy when you do get those guys, but it's more about relationships more than anything. I mean, you think about, you know, we can't make our own communication with players until their, you know, their junior year, the September of their junior year. So, you know, once I start talking to those guys, it's, you know, a constant, you know, weekly basis. I'm talking to these guys, or even their parents are texting me or calling me and checking in. Like I told you, you know, a couple of weeks ago, a parent texted me and said, "Coach, I was really happy to hear the podcast and understand, you know, listen to Coach Bruce talk about what the program is and who you guys are and the blue collar attitude." And he's like, "I'm really glad my son's going to you guys and going to be there in a couple of years," like that stuff. So it's a big relationship, and it's obviously can't be one-sided. We want the players to continually reach out to us, that, and we're not bombarding them with calls or texts and stuff like that. Obviously, we're going to check in and look at their numbers and see how they're playing, especially now that they're having a season. But we want those kids excited to come to school. And that's why it's always about it's about selling the school almost first in the program. We always tell kids, I was like, "Well, would you come to Nevada, Reno, if it wasn't for baseball?" And some of them don't know until they actually step on campus and then you see how beautiful our campus is. And they're like, "Whoa, you know, I had no idea this was here." And that's where you get them. And then you start, you know, hooking the family. It's about what you're going to get here overall, not just the program. The program's going to come and your baseball is going to be there, but the relationship that you build with those families and the kids and the parents, you know, that's the biggest thing. You end up getting Christmas cards, you know, from those families, and that's what you want to do. That's what you want to accomplish with a recruit right away.
I asked TJ about this a couple of weeks ago, but I also want to get your perspective when it comes to what you look for in a player. And you know what it's like to be someone who maybe got overlooked because of where they're from, or because, you know, they don't have 20/20 vision in both of their eyes. And so what are the things that you look for, both the tangibles and the intangibles, when finding recruits?
I think the biggest thing, being here and then knowing TJ, because obviously I recruit for my head coach, is you have to be tough. You have to be, but again, that goes back to me being a dirtbag and understanding what a dirtbag is and going into that program that Coach Snow started and Weathers and Buck continued, was you could come in on a 70% scholarship, but you can't come in thinking you're going to play right away. You got to come in wanting to earn a spot and receive honest coaching, I think, is the biggest thing, and constructive criticism and being able to work as hard as you can, even if you're the Friday night guy, or if you're the four hole, or if you're the starting shortstop, it doesn't matter. I think those are the intangibles you can't. And it's hard in this day of age, because me being coming from coaching high school and being in a high school and seeing what the generation is and some of these kids and entitlement, it's hard. It is hard because you're looking for that, you know, needle in a haystack type of kid who says it and is actually going to do what they say. Where a lot now is kids are saying it and you're not sure what's going to show up here. You know, "Oh, it sounds great on the phone and saying all the right things. And you're pumped up about this kid and you've offered them, they committed, you know, and then they show up and they're not exactly what they say." So a lot for us is, you know, be honest with who you are, and we're going to be honest with what we see. And you can't expect something until you prove you're going to be able to go after it every single day. And that's kind of what we look for. And it's right now for us, it's hard because we've been in a dead period since last March. where we've committed some kids, but we haven't seen them play. We're going off based off relationships with coaches and people we know in areas, and obviously video and our conversations with kids. But it's kind of knowing that, you know, they're going to be tough. They're going to be able to take on us coaching and not crumble when they're not, you know, when they're not playing or they're not getting their chance because they haven't proved it yet for us.
We'll wrap it up here momentarily. When it comes to walk-ons, and you've had walk-ons who are contributing to this year's team in past years, what should recruits know? What should families know about what it means to walk on to the Nevada baseball team and what those opportunities would be for them if they try to walk on?
There's two type of walk-on. There's a preferred walk-on who obviously recruit but doesn't get any money. And then there's a walk-on if we get tryouts and things like that. Usually there is a tryout in a normal year, and we see someone valuable to obviously our team and to our program who could come on and try to walk on in the fall and things like that for the spring. Preferred walk-ons, obviously, they're almost guaranteed a roster spot in some sense, but at the same time, as they have to try to make the team. And with those things, it's we treat, like I've told many of our players, and one of them obviously is Jacob Stinson, who is a walk-on, is you come in and you are treated the same way a scholarship player is. And you do not have to worry about being treated differently or worked differently or anything. And that's the biggest thing about our program. We don't care what scholarship you're on, where you come from, doesn't matter. If you're a walk-on and you outplay the guy who has 70% or is on scholarship, and you win the starting spot, you're our starting shortstop or you're our starting left fielder. It doesn't matter to us. And that's the key thing about what I love about the way we coach and the way we talk to our players. You come and show up, and you show up every day, and you show us that you can do something and help this team win. We're going to take you over anything because you're telling us more with your work ethic and the way you carry yourself than telling us, you know, that, you know, you're getting a scholarship and you're this guy and you've been ranked in whatever perfect, you know, whatever scouting report. It doesn't matter. You just keep your mouth quiet and say the right things, and you work harder than every guy. And then that's not a problem. That's why we do like guys who walk on, because they're going to push the guy in front of them who thinks that, and that guy will probably end up losing his job.
All right, Abe, this ended up going much, much longer than I was expecting it to go on, but I'm really glad because, you know, I just love the story of your career and then what you stand for now as a coach. And so thanks so much for being so generous with your time. I loved it all. Thank you again.
Yeah, no problem, Josh. Anytime you need me again, I love it. It's good talking life, good talking baseball, so it's a good thing. Appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. Once again, that is Abe Alvarez. He is one of 19,929 players at the moment of this recording who reached the major leagues. He's got a ring. He played 7 years and now coach, recruiting coordinator for the Nevada Wolf Pack. This was episode 4 of Howling with the Pack. I'm your host, Josh Sushom. We'll talk to you again next week.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.